no relevant financial relationships. Okay, let me get, I'm Gene DeClercq. I'm at the BU School of Public Health, apparently I'm putting on weight. I think I was the one who was referring to as a heavyweight, and I'll try to overcome that with a sterling presentation. This isn't about either birth centers or midwives, so I'm not quite, this happens at APHA. You sort of end up on a panel, even though it's not, you know, specifically on a topic. I've certainly done research on those things before. This is a more specific study around repeat cesareans, and let me begin with an apology that some of the things we wanted to find in this we haven't gotten to yet, and so these results that I'll present are more preliminary than I would have liked, and I'll explain a little bit why as we go through it. I have colleagues Candace Belanoff and Mark McLaughlin on this. I also owe a debt to a number of colleagues at BU and elsewhere. Howard Cabral, Fifi Diop, Linda Hefner, Mil Kotelchuk, and most importantly and most gratefully, this research is supported by a grant from the Maternal Child Health Bureau, and I apologize to them that I'm not further along as well. I'm just loaded with guilt up here about all of these things. So I'm going to talk about repeat cesareans and outcomes of repeat cesareans. And so just for context, the first three or four slides are just contextual slides. This is the VBAC rate in the United States. Note 2005 to 2008 is not official because of changes in the birth certificate. If you go to the NCHS data, they stopped reporting it in 2004. You can impute it from playing with the data, and that's what you get when you impute it, but I do not speak for my NCHS colleagues on that. Am I okay now? Okay, good. And this is a breakdown of those same data by month. Through 2006, looking at changes in the VBAC rate over time. You might wonder, why would you look at it by month? And there's two answers. One, it might illustrate relationships to particular events or particular publications, and secondly, it reflects an emptiness in my life that I'm not completely proud of, and I just have to deal with as well in all of this. But what you see is, you know, the trend is related to research, it's related to different studies. In particular, that steady rise to the early 90s that peaks in 1996 is a notable study by McMahon et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine. It starts to come down. There's the SACS is a sounding board, actually. It's not a research study. ACOG issues a pair of new guidelines through that period of time. Then there's the, in 2001, an article by Mona Leiden-Rochelle, and most importantly, an accompanying editorial. And if you look closely, you can see there's a sort of the usual sort of erratic drop going through, and right after those is actually a 3 percentage point drop in the national rate of VBACs in the two-month period. But then it continues to decline. And what's notable is maybe the best study in this whole period is the one by Landon and colleagues using a really strong database and thoughtfully analyzed that had no, and it gave a much more positive picture to VBACs, and it had no impact whatsoever. This is the United States in comparative context, looking at the VBAC rate in the United States compared to other industrialized countries. And you can see, yeah, and the person from the Netherlands stands up. My experience in international talks is people from the Netherlands always stand up when they can. It's a proud country. And they have far and away the highest VBAC rate, reflective partly of their home births. We're right behind Latvia, which is where I think we all aspire to be in these cases. This is an important point. This is the relationship between the primary cesarean rate and the VBAC rate. And if you actually do the correlation between the two, it's almost a perfect negative correlation. And the point of that is, for those who are advocates in one side or another of this, is the impact working on one has on the other, I think. That, you know, as we work on VBAC, it has an impact on primary cesareans. You work to reduce primary cesarean rates, that has the more obvious impact on lowering the VBAC rate because it makes it less of an issue. But it's about culture of practice that's really what we're dealing with here. So there have been shifting attitudes towards VBACs in recent years. There was the NIH meeting in 2010 on vaginal birth after cesareans, and if you attended it or were aware of it, it was a much more positive look at it, partly because they had funded all these studies like Landon's study. And this is not NIH, but my own perception of it was they were frustrated that they weren't having any traction. All these very good studies had no traction on the VBAC rate nationally. There was an evidence report, the vaginal birth after cesarean, new insights. I would encourage anybody, it's available free online, you can download the PDF, it's like 300 pages, but you can download if you really want to know what the literature is. It's a very thoughtful review of all of that. And maybe the biggest impact of it all was right after, as you can see in the lower left-hand corner, ACOG put out a new practice bulletin in August of 2010. And they changed the rules a little bit around that. This is just one of the examples of what came out of the evidence study, and it was a look at, and so they broke it down. There were six questions overall, and again, I'm not here to talk about this specifically, this is still background, but what are the short and long-term benefits and harms to the mother and, you know, to the baby? They did the same analysis there. In this case, long-term benefits of trials of labor, high-grade evidence, none, because, again, you're not going to do much in the way of randomized trials, right? And that's highest-grade evidence. Moderate-grade evidence, avoidance of placental problems, and they present data on that. Now, I use this as the kickoff to what we were looking at in our research, and the point is this. Most all of the studies of repeat cesareans have been cross-sectional studies because there's a power issue here. In terms of statistical power of looking at it. And so what they almost inevitably do is look at compare mothers who've had one cesarean with mothers who've had two cesareans with mothers who have three cesareans. We have the opportunity in Massachusetts, because as you all know, things are always better in Massachusetts than in other places, to look at this because we have a data set that allows us to do that. And so basically it's this. And I'm not going to go through all of the data set, but we call it the PEL, Pregnancy to Early Life Longitudinal Database. And what we've done with that is link birth certificates to hospital discharge records ever since 1998. So we're now up to 1998 through, we just finished 2008. I won't go into why there's so many delays, but there are. And that's the core linkage you see in the middle. We're up to 875,000 births at this point. And the other piece, and then that is in turn linked to a whole array of other data sets here. What the result is that in that 11-year period, we have about 876,000 births, which is 860,000 deliveries, because obviously some are plural deliveries. We have 4,700 fetal deaths. We're linked to the fetal death database. That's from a total of 547,000 mothers. Repeat mothers, mothers who show up more than once in the database, that's about 224,000. For this analysis, we're looking at repeat mothers whose first birth is in PEL. All right, it's because we didn't want to get into not knowing. I mean, obviously, we have a number of mothers whose second, third, and fourth births might be in PEL. We wanted to look at mothers who start in PEL, and so we can follow them forward. This is just a description of the database, and I just want to note one particular aspect. So those are the time periods we have for the data sets. Birth certificate is a one point in time. Data set. But hospital discharge, I should have actually extended the circle to observational stay and emergency room visits, is longitudinal. We can link, because we have the link to the birth certificate, we link that to the hospital discharge record. The hospital discharge record has an encrypted social security number we can use to then link forward and backward. And that's the key to the whole study. Because we can then say, here's a woman who gives birth in 2001. Did she have any other births? We can link to all of those other births going forward and do the kind of analysis that we will ultimately be doing, not all of which is done today. And so you can see the increase in mothers who appear two or more times in PEL through this period of time. And it accelerates, and it's important. And that's an important issue for us, because part of the delay is I really want to look at third and fourth mothers who have three and four. And that jumps a whole lot as time goes on. And you just, because obviously you're constrained, you're cut off on the firsts, but the others can go forward. This is the breakdown of mothers with a first birth in PEL from 1998 to 2008. And so of those mothers, 213,000 have had one, 138,000 mothers now with two births, 31,000 with three, 4,600 with four. That's data through 2008. We can run the birth certificate to get that number. We didn't have the whole data set ready. So everything else you'll see is through 2007, not through 2008. The 2008 data literally arrived for us last week, for me last week. So in this particular, in the repeat cesarean study, there's actually several arms to it. I can't actually say that word very well. Several wings to it, several, however you want to do it. We're looking at maternal outcomes, we're looking at infant outcomes, and so all of the data sets in red are used in the overall study here. So we can look at, you know, birth defects, child and mother deaths, pregnancy-associated deaths. The numbers are small, obviously, maternal deaths for any one state, but the linked birth and infant death and so on. For the material I'll talk about today, these are the ones. The paper proposed for this was just on maternal deaths, and so we'll be talking about that, although you'll see a little bit on perinatal death. So the questions, the primary question is, what are the maternal outcomes associated with repeat cesareans? The secondary question, what's the pattern of mothers' experiences across their birth experiences by method of delivery? Because we wanted to establish that first, and because it was a unique experience, as I think you'll see. Today I'm reporting primarily on the secondary question. So this is what I mean by patterns of hospitalization. What we can do when we look at a mother's birthing experiences is take birth one. We can go back using gestational age data to go back to look at a prenatal hospitalization. Going forward, then we have the birth hospitalization and events associated with that, both the birth certificate and the hospital discharge. Then we can go and look at, were there any interpregnancy hospitalizations between birth one and birth two? Then we can look at prenatal hospitalizations in birth two, the events around birth two, and so on, going forward. And ultimately, we'll be doing that through essentially four births. The patterns of method of delivery across these births are as follows. This is, again, now this is only looking at women with two single, if you're wondering why the number is 176,000, it's only looking at women first birth in Pell and only two. The initial data we're going to analyze is with that. And what you see is, of those mothers, about 68% had two vaginal deliveries. 6% had a vaginal and then a secondary primary. A second birth was a primary cesarean, and that's an area I'm going to encourage more research in, by the way, generally at the end. And then the classic primary and repeat cesareans, and then the much smaller proportion of mothers having a primary cesarean and a VBAC. If you're saying that 2.9% seems low, actually it's normal in the sense that, you know, when we report VBAC rates, it's based on VBACs and repeat cesareans. This is proportion of all births that we're presenting here. This is the pattern for three mothers, just to give you a sense of the numbers and why I'm delaying a bit to build up the numbers. Because when you look at this, it gets a bit more complicated. I won't go through all of them, just the highlighted ones. So about 17,000 mothers with three vaginal births, about 4,000 mothers with three cesarean births, about 590 mothers with a primary cesarean and two VBACs. And in the three birth analysis, which I won't be going into today, that's going to be our major focus. So what's the pattern of hospital contacts? Now, hospital contacts means either an actual admission to the hospital or an observational stay or an emergency room visit, right? So it's, and that's why the term is hospital contacts, not hospital discharges. And so what you find is, I think one of the things that people are always surprised at is the levels of hospitalizations, although if you look at the literature, they talk about this for quite some time. The prenatal hospitalizations, about 22.7% of mothers had a prenatal hospitalization. That's the number in blue up there in that upper left-hand box. 6.3% had an emergency room hospitalization in that time. In the interpregnancy period, which averaged 776 days, and which we haven't done the multivariate analysis yet, but just on the core analysis, didn't vary by whether or not a mother had a vaginal or a cesarean delivery in her first birth, which is an area of contention in this world. For the interpregnancy hospitalizations, about 25% of the mothers had some kind, though most of them were emergency room visits. In the second prenatal hospitalizations, again, about 25%, but fewer are emergency room visits. And then in the year postpartum, just to make that consistent, in the year postpartum to the second birth, about 16% had a hospitalization, most of which were emergency room visits. So the question then becomes, how do these vary by method of delivery? And here's more data than you ever wanted to deal with. But basically, down the left-hand columns, those are the four types that you can have, four combinations one could have And across the top are those four periods we're talking about. And I won't go through all the numbers. I'll just note the ones in blue are the ones with the highest rates by period. And what you see, interestingly enough, is the highest rate of hospitalizations in the first prenatal period is for mothers with a primary cesarean, which perhaps makes sense, right? This is not risk-adjusted yet. And so they have the highest rates. What maybe you don't expect is, well, maybe the second one, 30.4% of mothers were hospitalized in the inter-pregnancy period among those who had a vaginal and then a primary, suggesting perhaps some risk factor occurs in the interpregnancy period that leads to that cesarean in her second birth, even though she had a vaginal birth the first time. What I didn't actually expect was that that would continue to be the group with the highest rates of hospitalization. Again, we haven't done the more elaborate analysis, so this could just all be interesting descriptive stuff that's not going to hold up. But it certainly is interesting descriptive, isn't it? In terms of the people with the lowest rates of hospitalizations, it's the mothers with VBACs who end up with VBACs, a primary cesarean and a VBAC. And the initial question is, what were they doing with the primary cesarean, given they had the lowest rates of prenatal hospitalization? But from that point on, even in the interpregnancy period before they have the VBAC, they have the lowest rates of hospitalization. Now, the other caveat on this is that may be a social class factor in terms of the... But having said that, we did do that analysis, and it's not just driven by emergency room. Because one obvious assumption is these rates are driven by emergency rooms. Emergency room visits are more likely among poorer mothers. They have greater risk problems and so on. They're related. I mean, what you see is if you limit it to emergency room or you limit it to just hospital admissions and observational stays, you pretty much get the same pattern. It doesn't vary that much. And again, what's also intriguing is that profound difference over time between the mothers with that second cesarean and the mothers with a VBAC, in terms of strong differences in the period leading up to that second cesarean and actually subsequent to that second cesarean. This just highlights another. This is the same data. I just wanted to highlight a different set of relationships. What happens in the mothers who have two cesareans and two vaginal births? In those cases, again, the mothers with an initial cesarean are more likely to have been hospitalized in their first prenatal period. But after that, there isn't much difference there in hospitalization rates, which may undermine some of our premises that we would like to hold on to as to the implications of that first cesarean. This just presents it graphically. It's the same data presented graphically to see if people... Depends how you relate to things. Some of us relate to numbers, and some of us relate to pictures, and so this is for those who relate to pictures. And you can see across the four groups, which were more distinctly colored, by the way, in my original for some reason, but you see the patterns that almost consistently that vaginal birth and then a primary cesarean group is the most likely to experience a hospital contact. This is just the emergency room. For those of you who didn't believe me when I said this earlier, this is the emergency room data, and you can see pretty much the same pattern. And this is the hospital and observational stay, pretty much the same pattern, although a little bit in the latter periods, a little bit of difference there. But essentially, the group that's highest is the highest in all of the comparisons. Okay, two other cool findings before I end. All right, this is to make up for the fact that I don't have my outcome data. One is that when you use linked data that links birth certificates and hospital discharge rates, you actually get a clearer indication of what the VBAC rate is. And it's actually higher than it's reported on the birth certificate. Because if you think about it, to report either a VBAC rate or a repeat cesarean rate, you need two pieces of information, right? What happened in this birth and what happened in the last birth. And what happens is, essentially, both repeat cesareans and VBACs get undercounted. They're more likely to be counted as a vaginal birth or a primary cesarean. When you combine it with the hospital discharge data, you can do a refined measure. When we did the refined measure, two things. One, it's higher. The VBAC rates are a little bit higher, not overwhelmingly, but a little bit higher consistently through this period. But those differences are decreasing over time, which may reflect, I mean, we haven't adopted the new birth certificate yet in Massachusetts, but maybe it reflects better recording on the birth certificate. And then this was a preliminary bit of work we did just to validate some measures, but, some really interesting things emerge. This is the benefit of having that first birth and second birth data for the same woman to look at. Now, we're not the first people to have it. We may have more of it than most everybody else has ever had in terms of just size of the data set. So I just wanted to highlight four areas that emerge. If a mother had a perinatal death in her first, so either a fetal death or a death in the first 7 days, in her first birth, 4.8%, about 1 in 20 of those mothers, will have a perinatal death in the second. For those mothers who didn't have a perinatal death in the first, it's really unlikely, 0.2%, that they would have one in the second. So in terms of sort of clinical interest, obviously it would hardly be an insight to clinicians to say, gee, if a mother had a bad experience the first time, you have to watch more carefully, but it emphasizes it even more. In terms of birth weight, for mothers who had a low birth weight baby in the first birth, again, they're much, much more likely to have a low birth weight baby in the second birth. If a mother had a high birth weight baby, a macrosomic baby in the first birth, they're also more likely, but only about one-third of them. They've always reported this, and they always use that, and that's actually one of the subtle indications for cesarean, right, a previous macrosomic birth. But what this suggests is about two-thirds of the time, that baby isn't going to be macrosomic in the second birth. Smoking, for the public health people here. This room is mostly full of birthers. I know who you are. But there's also public health people here as well, and that means you're not interested in birth. You're interested in prenatal care and postpartum care. I'm a public health person as well, and this is a fight I always have. And so the issue of smoking reflects some success. If a mother smokes in her first pregnancy, about 65% of the time she reports smoking in her second. But 35% of the time they stop. If a mother didn't smoke in her first pregnancy, she almost never smokes in the second. So again, from public health, targeting public health programs, there are some values in terms of working with those mothers for that second birth, and it reflects that we probably have had some success. And then finally, hospital contacts. Again, if a mother showed up in the hospital in her first birth, what was the likelihood she would show up in her second birth? And what you see, first of all, again, about 20% of the mothers had some kind of hospital contact in the first, 79% did not. But they are much more likely to have a second hospitalization than other mothers will. And it monotonically declines, according to experience in the first birth. So again, suggesting the value of risk adjustment based on first birth experiences. So, summary, use of a longitudinally linked data set gives us a basis for a more complete analysis of the experiences of mothers across multiple births. And distinct patterns of hospitalizations emerge when examining maternal experiences by method of delivery. I mean, it's not life course, because we're not going back to birth in the sense of the kid, the mothers here, but it's life course of the maternity experience of mothers that we can now document better than we ever could before. Limitations, we haven't done the multivariate analysis. Actually, we have run some of it, but I want it to be cleaner before I present it. We only presented data on two births here from 98 to 07 with the 2008 data, which I will start working on as soon as I get back. We'll substantially increase the number of third and fourths. We're going to look particularly at placental outcomes, which, again, has been found in most cross-sectional studies. This is at vital stats and administrative data. It's combined, it's linked, it's refined, it's better than the usual, but it's not medical records data, as I find out every time I submit it to a clinical journal, and they write back and said it's not medical records data. And there was an issue of too much data. You know, we got so overwhelmed when we were running those first analyses that you could easily get lost in that, and that's a problem. So next steps, add the 2008 data, explore new questions. We're going to go back, though, and look at this pattern of hospitalization. It wasn't our initial focus, but this is too interesting not to examine. Look at the pattern of hospitalizations over time. Massachusetts is negotiating to add all payers claims database, which would be would have non-hospital, ambulatory care. If we have that, there's no end to what we'll study. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.